Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Maggie Jackson. Maggie is an award-winning author and social critic with a global reach. Her latest book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure, explores why we should seek not knowing in an era of angst and flux. In this conversation, Maggie shares why uncertainty isn't a problem to solve, but a space to work within. Drawing on insights from neuroscience, leadership, and team dynamics, she explores how working at the edge of what we know can sharpen thinking, foster better group decision-making, and open the door to voices that are too often overlooked. From Mars missions to modern workplace, her research shows that high-performing teams don't eliminate uncertainty. They use it to think more deeply, listen more closely, and collaborate more effectively. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by Maggie Jackson. Maggie is a journalist, a social critic, and most recently the author of one of her newer books, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure, which is a wonderful read. I've actually listened to it as well. And it's just great to be talking with you again, Maggie. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. Wonderful.
So for the benefit of our listeners, you know, tell us a little bit more about you. How did you come to be doing this work? How did you stumble across uncertainty?
Sure. Well, I come from a journalism background, as you mentioned, and I think it all started when I was a foreign correspondent in Asia, Tokyo and London, traveling around the world and writing kind of big picture social trends. And I just loved it. I loved tackling, big, messy topics, really. I got back to the United States and I became one of the first work-life balance columnists, writing about workplace and equity issues, diversity. So there was a long line of, again, writing about trends and then more and more into technology's impact on humanity. So I'm just kind of interested in being at the edge.
It's interesting. We've had a few guests come and talk to us about being at the edge and how that's a very kind of energizing place for new thoughts, new ideas, and all that can come with, not just innovation, but just exploring what is less well known.
Exactly. And what might unfold for us? I don't see myself as a futurist per se, or I'm not into that, kind of realm of foresight thinking. But I also try to balance between timeless human issues, which is an exhaustible maelstrom of questions right there, and then what we are facing today. So what is tried and true, what will remain? But yet what we're facing at this minute in time, I think those are really interesting sort of paradoxes to unfold.
Absolutely. And when you think over, just the last 5 years have been pretty tumultuous, but if you go back over the last decade, the various themes that have been impacting humanity or that we've been living through, what have been some of those core areas of focus that you've been drawn towards?
Yes, well, I actually see Uncertain, this new book, as the end of a trilogy. And so it's actually taken me 20 years to write these three books. I've done other things in between, but my first book was about the nature of home in the digital age and where we find refuge when home is permeable and portable, very tech-infused. And then the second one was called Distracted. And I was trying to tackle some of the through line of humanity's coping or adaptation to technology, even going back hundreds of years, and then particularly what it means for attention, which is an overlooked faculty that most of us couldn't even define. And then finally, uncertainty. So basically all these books really emerged, and I didn't even realize it was happening until 2/3 through the last one, but they all are about messy topics right under our noses, you know, very much part and parcel of average daily living, and yet topics that, again, we couldn't define or we don't really know, or that are very newly explored scientifically or research-wise. So that's another sort of strange and fascinating thing that, you know, uncertainty or even attention weren't really mapped and tracked and even understood until very, very recently.
Yeah, the attention piece is captivating to me because I've got a lot of friends and family that would either identify as or have actually been diagnosed as, you know, ADD, attention deficit disorder. And, you know, with all of the technology that's upon us, we have so many distractions in general. So, you know, how do you see that playing out into some of these larger themes around like human connection and loneliness, you know, from the body of your work?
Yeah, I think that the very, very simplistically or reductively, I'd say that the technologies we live with today speak to one side of ourselves, the heuristic kind of shortcut, instant intuitive side of ourselves, so that it leads to the impression that we can sort of what I like to say know at a glance. And Marshall McLuhan actually talked about all at once-ness, which is so perfect. And so when we are increasingly relating to and depending and relying on devices for answers or for connections, for whatever, we're funneling these parts of the human condition through a pretty narrow window of experience and values. And I think that that's why it's not Luddite, it's not contrarian, it's not anti-progress to constantly inquire, you know, what this is doing to us, to constantly question. And maybe someday we will have technologies that are more contemplative or allow for or cultivate pausing and reflection and deep sustained attention. But right now, I would say we don't. And that's why the boundaries are very important in our lives. Although, you know, I'm on my computer all day and my research has changed for the good as a result of the internet, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing, finally, what I'd say is that I'm heartened or have been heartened by the maturation of the conversation in and around technology, because for hundreds of years, technology has really, the conversation has been at first dominated by the inventors. And then there's a push and play back and forth between users and technology and invention. Now I think we don't want to be reductive again, but this sort of massive questioning of technology is helping us to hopefully move beyond the binary. Like, it's fantastic or it's the end of everything.
Yeah.
We need to move beyond the binary. And so I'm hoping we can carry some of that, you know, kind of sophistication and complexity into our discussions about AI. We might be taking a step backwards when it comes to AI. You know, gotta get it, you know, adopt. Yeah. But wow, I hope we have more mature conversations.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. When I was coming up through high school in England, there was an opportunity to study a course called PPE, Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. And I was, at that time, I loved economics. I'm like, why economics and philosophy? But from what I'm hearing you say, we're actually in a stage where we need to be talking about technology and philosophy as well.
Yeah, exactly. We need all parts of ourselves and all, you know, we need the humanities more than ever. I'll just put my little flag in the ground right
yeah.
there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's, I think we need to look. What I've always tried to do in my books is take an issue and do a walkabout, almost a 360-degree look. And it's daunting and perhaps, you know, a reach, for me to draw on different disciplines, but I try to do so carefully with the help and of the experts who are in those fields and try to not not write a book on distraction that's just about ADHD, because there are many more parts to it. And so I think that that's just the way I operate, but it offers a little bit less a narrow specialized view on these big topics, these big aspects of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I know before the show, Maggie, we were talking about uncertainty and teamwork and sort of the role it plays in and around collaboration. What might you be able to share there on what you started to see, you know, as you were getting deeper and deeper into the research and the writing of the book?
Yeah, sure. Well, the book Uncertain explores why we should actually seek uncertainty in these dynamic times. And by uncertainty, the major definition, I'll just throw it out because it helps, offer a structure, a framework, because it's such a messy topic. There are basically two types of uncertainty. Experts agree. One is the uncertainty, or what's out there, what humans can't know despite all the mathematical modeling, et cetera. And then there's the human response to the unknown, which is AKA our epistemic uncertainty. So basically the question is, it's a volatile world, increasingly so. How will we respond? And the answer according to this incredibly new science of uncertainty is that, we need to basically do a reframe on our insufficient ideas about unsureness, about, questioning, about, uncertainty is seeming synonymous with weakness and inertia. And that's not mm-hmm. true, whether it's in mm-hmm. leadership or teams. So to get back to your question, I was finding out, incredible ways in which, CEOs who are in the middle of long-term crises, who are ambivalent, are more inclusive. They seek, multiple perspectives. That's according to a gold standard study in Europe at the advent of the expansion of the European Union. It's been a really incredibly famous study. And that's really an interesting window there on teamwork. The leader who is ambivalent is saying, well, it could be this, it could be that, it might be this. Uncertainty is not ignorance. It's actually working at the edge of what you know. It's actually, as I said, responding to the unknown, but with the recognition that you've reached the limits of your knowledge. So there's a crisis, or you need a new project. If you're unsure, a new product, if you're unsure, there's a meta cognitive recognition that you're at the edge of what you know, and that that's the time to basically update your knowledge, not to fall back on the old, the tried and the true, the routine, And so another way to put uncertainty is to say that it's, hands down, a signal. Your uncertainty is literally, physiologically, and cognitively a signal that one neuroscientist told me that uncertainty is the brain telling itself there's something to be learned here. That's why we feel uneasy. That's why we feel stressed. It's, it's a sort of adaptive response to the new that actually readies us to learn and perform. So I think, while social, uncertainty, being unsure, really doesn't seem as though that's what we would want in a team. Mm. And especially the messaging today is, hiring for fit, or tamping down on the friction of diversity, or getting on the same page. And, one messaging from a major manufacturer, it's actually a soft drink, put out ads saying, we are family. And these sort of messages kind of inspire the idea that agreement is where you want to be. And what I found is, first of all, we know that groupthink is not good. That's almost like a cliche.
Yeah.
But the depth of, problems, I would even say toxicity of agreement, is far more than I expected.
Interesting.
Teams that are in agreement. Now, of course, we want to be in agreement by the end. You know, you want to have a goal. You want to have a good outcome. You want to be on the same page, you know, as you hammer out that new budget or what have you. But to prioritize agreement means even if the team is diverse, even if they come together in a very short time, temporarily even a focus group or something, teams that are in agreement are less creative, less accurate, and they begin to see one another as more similar than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And then as their performance is declining, they actually think they're doing jolly well.
Yeah.
Because accord or agreement is fluent. It's where humans want to be. It seems the easy way. In fact, our brain actually, I went over your brain on agreement and your brain on disagreement with a top Yale neuroscientist, Joy Hirsch, who told me basically the disagreeing brain is energetic. The agreeing brain is, she said, colloquially, using less real estate. So you're kind of, I call it the love seat of accord. You know, we love to be there. We love to hang out there. And everything seems fine and a lot gets overlooked. And this is true whether you're on the Supreme Court or in the boardroom or, you know, workplace teams, et cetera.
Yeah. I listened to a really cool podcast the other day. It was a gentleman, Marcus Buckingham was the guest. And he talked about, as humans, we're all unique. We all have these trillions of synapses that fire in very different ways. And what you were just sharing there around sort of agreement, you know, and groupthink sort of using less real estate and maybe being a little bit more calm for people. For me, that actually is boredom. That's what it feels like, you know. And it's not that I'm always looking to go out and kind of find disagreement or conflict, but I do find that's my personal experience. So maybe that's kind of just the way that I fire, based on Buckingham's research. So I wonder, Maggie, when you're looking at some of these teams or some of these leaders when they're facing uncertainty, are there particular leaders that just like to be ambivalent and playing in the curious creative world versus some that are much more aligned with a known path forwards?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I'll just add before we get to that one other point about disagreement, because I think it's really important and how uncertainty factors in. So, you know, I've been describing the sort of toxicity of agreement. And so the antidote, of course, is that friction, airing differences, you know, particularly respectfully. But what's we often think is that when we're disagreeing, the good, you know, the successful collaboration will emerge from having the right side win, or, you know, the right answer comes in. And that actually puts a lot of onus unfairly on the person who is diverse. Mm. I'll just tangentially but importantly note that. That's not really actually what is happening when you have great collaboration with disagreement, because even the dissenting voice or the disagreeing voice that's wrong, it's just making a wrong point, actually bolsters team performance.
Hmm.
So what's really happening here, and this is where uncertainty comes in, is that disagreement that's respectful actually sparks a new group mindset, which is questioning and curious and skeptical. And then the discussions intensify and the creativity blossoms and all those sort of things, because people are kind of jolted from their assumptions, they're slowed down a bit from snap judgment, all that kind of really smooth, facile, fluent agreement gets shaken. And that's when we become great thinkers together. And that's really an important point, I think. And so I did research into the Mars Exploration Rover mission, those incredible teams at NASA that put the rovers on Mars, and 20% of their conversations were micro conflicts, and 100% were involving expressions of uncertainty. Like, you know, I read the transcripts and they said, you know, well, it could be this, but I don't think so. And, you know, perhaps we, so these are not, they're not throwing things at each other and yelling and polarizing. They are working together within the space of possibilities that's uncertainty. So I think that was, that's just a really important point too. It's, I think that's a very surprising kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
Right there. And uncertainty just isn't thought about when it comes to, you know, let's get a good team together and make sure we're uncertain together, because there's so many cultural biases against being unsure. But that's where the action happens. And it again, it happens in so many different kinds of groups. If you have a Mount Everest climbing expedition, and people out of Stanford did tremendous in-depth research, historical, longitudinal, again, gold standard research on what makes a good expedition team. If you have a team that's really diverse in terms of knowledge and experience in the Himalayas or mountains or something, and then they emphasize an all-for-one mentality, like, you know, we are one, and on the ascent or descent, they're far more likely to lose, to actually experience the death of a member on average, which is pretty stunning.
Yeah.
That all-for-one, as one scientist told me, Lindgren Greer at the University of Michigan told me, that they lose sight of the fact that there is an expert there. They're so focused on relationship building. Wow. And they, you know, this, again, occurs in many different types of groups. So I think that's, you know, a really, and she called that terrifying, right there in their midst, right there in their midst, were experts who were experienced, and they weren't heeded. Everyone was just putting on that, you know, agreement hat.
Yeah, that's very real. I actually had a good friend, Craig Weber, who talks a lot about conversational capacity. And one of his great sound bites was, you're stealing from the company if you're in a room of people and you're not encouraging people to share, you know, what's really going in their mind, whether they're uncertain about something that's being said. So in the expedition sense, it's the same.
Exactly. And that's actually, there's a word for it called the hidden profile. Most groups discuss what's already known, a team, you know, meetings, etc., what everybody already knows. But the hidden profile is just a term for the individual information that people have that gets overlooked. And if you put together a disagreement to cultivate uncertainty, that alleviates, you know, that unearths the hidden profile. And then that's another reason why collaboration improves. So it's pretty powerful. And isn't that inclusivity? Isn't that listening to voices? Isn't that where we want to be as leaders, as managers, or just a member of a team? Everyone can be heard. And I think that uncertainty is the, you know, the secret rocket fuel that's been overlooked for too long.
Yeah, I like the way you frame it as rocket fuel too. I had a guest on the show last week and he talked about it being truly human, a truly human behavior to be curious and to create. And yet so many of our businesses, partly due to all of the technology that we've got now, have taken away curiosity and creativity from people's jobs.
Yes, yes, exactly. There's also so much outcome fixation that the process gets lost. Mm. And that's one of the things that actually dials back or, again, undermines positive uncertainty and better decision making is to be focused during a challenge on the outcome. You focus on whether or not you're failing. You're focused on the outcome when you should be focusing on the process. And the process entails that attunement to what's going on, that discernment, that, you know, wading in, inhabiting the question. And again, it's truly actually uncertainty is a physiological and neural state related to good stress. When you're unsure, your working memory goes up, your attention heightens, your brain becomes more receptive to new data. So this is true in the group or on your own, you know, giving a presentation. Mm-hmm. You know, you look around, important people in the room, they seem to be glowering. Maybe they're just concentrating. You begin to think you're failing. Well, you have just lost that chance to be in, you know, to open up to the signal of uncertainty and then thrive in that moment. I mean, that finding alone really changed my, you know, public presentation mode.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
It has to do with mindfulness, doesn't it? It kind of makes mindfulness really a lot, you know, come alive, because being in the moment is sort of a hard, mushy thing, but that's what groups do when they're, you know, really opening up to the uncertainty, opening up to what they don't know.
Yeah.
That's not a comfy place to be.
No, it's not. No. It's interesting. I was working with Andre Martin the other day, who actually introduced us. And Andre was in there working with this team, and we all agreed that wouldn't it be cool in the workplace if we came together for that conversation of what may be possible versus coming together to kind of tick boxes and do data readouts together.
Yes, exactly. I was working with a podcast about museum education, and uh-huh. You know, groups come in to the museum, and the educators now are trying to move away from lecture style. Now that's a group kind of almost like a teamwork, on the spot teamwork. And the educator was asking, well, you know, but if I try to get off the script, people get uncomfortable and they don't answer. And I, you know, really want to say, maybe give it a minute. You know, maybe it's uncomfortable, but we don't need to swipe right, or maybe swipe left. I don't know.
Yeah.
We don't need to swipe that away. And we need to practice at being uncomfortable. And the CEOs who I talked about who were ambivalent and yet thrived, they were the ones who were also more resourceful. A year later, when the researchers came back to study their responses to that big marketplace expansion in the EU, they weren't in a comfortable place, I'm sure, to be ambivalent, to think of different operations. But wow, what a powerful state to be in. And also, I think it's important to underline, again, as a team or a solo, as a leader, as a person, that all of this is takes practice. Everything I'm talking about is not just, hey, be unsure and snap into it, and there you go, everything will be peachy. It's not a panacea, and it's not automaticity. In fact, it's getting away from automaticity, because yeah. Automaticity is, you know, relying on the past, which is good in a predictable situation. A benign environment is when you can rely on your heuristic judgment, your mental models, your expertise. When you're working at the edge, you know, in a new complex problem, then, you know, it's not that all bets are off. You can use your knowledge, but you want to extend your knowledge and then understand, diagnose the situation. It's improvisational. That's what edge work is. You're poking into the frontier of what you don't know, and that's okay. It's not the disaster. It's not an abyss. It's where we can gain skill. But active, skillful uncertainty is what we can aim for, and that's strategic uncertainty, productive. That's what I'm calling it.
I like it. And when you think on that, going back to that earlier question, when there's, it can be practiced, but there are certain people that maybe have a more innate preference for those environments. Like, I wonder, even in that EU case study, was it that percentage of leaders that were ambivalent? Was that maybe even just their very nature that took them there?
Yes. No, I'm glad you circled back to that important question. And well, it might have, there's probably more we don't know about, you know, how to answer that question. But there's a lot of attention now to a personality trait called tolerance of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. A lot of attention in medicine, and also growing attention in business, and in other walks of life. Tolerance of uncertainty is a personality trait that, you know, kind of like shyness or conscientiousness, is a spectrum. So you or I might be more or less tolerant of uncertainty. And just to put it, you know, briefly, people who are highly intolerant of uncertainty Well, for example, during the pandemic, if you're really intolerant of uncertainty, you're more likely to cope with denial, avoidance, and substance abuse. You know, pretty raw stuff. If you're more tolerant of uncertainty during the acute phase of the pandemic, you'd be more likely to accept the realities of the situation and see the situation as a challenge. So people who are intolerant, they really dislike, they fear, they dread uncertainty. They are far more likely to see it as a threat and act, you know, as you can see, what I'm describing is a closing down versus an opening up and a facing up to the unknown. So this personality trait, there are two important points here. First of all, it's situational. So anytime we are under pressure to give an answer, or we're tired, or we're information overloaded, we all tend to drift further to intolerance. We want to get out of that place of uncertainty. That's natural. And it's natural because we evolved as organisms to need and want answers. So we dislike it. It's stressful, but it's good stress. And hey, you know, hang there, give it a chance. You can be skillful. That's the message. The second thing that's really important is that it's mutable, so that therefore there's a lot of work now on training people in building their tolerance of uncertainty. You know, stressed high schoolers, leaders, people in doctors. There's a lot of work now in training people to be more tolerant of uncertainty. And it's remarkably successful at building resilience and also even treating anxiety and other mental disorders.
Yep.
So that very, very exciting work. The greatest thing is that it's basically all of this technique and approaches to bolstering tolerance of uncertainty and resilience is really based a lot so far on exposure therapy type techniques. So all that means is, if I'm afraid of a dog, I want to sit next to a stuffed puppy, then move on to a little, you know, tiny dog, etc. I'm exposing myself to dogness. So too, expose yourself to the unknown. Take it in small bites. Be incremental. Be the leader who delegates a little more rather than holding control and thinking no one else can do the work.
Yeah.
Be the leader who is more comfortable, with the what if questions. And then in your home life, you can let your kids pack their suitcase for a trip, or you can try a new dish in a restaurant. I really laughed at that. These are actual exercises that are being used successfully for training and teaching and treating people. And I thought, well, some of this is so simple. But then I realized, well, no, it's not. It's, you know, you're tired. You want the familiar. You want to retreat into the little cave of what you already know rather than sticking your nose out into the wider world of what you don't know. And there's so many implications for this, so many implications. And so you're right. Some leaders do gravitate more to that. I had some wonderful interchanges with the number two head of digital transformation in Ukraine, operating in the war. I mean, incredible guy. They've done so much to transfer social services online so that people don't have to go out, et cetera. But he has an assistant who is hugely not tolerant of uncertainty, working in a war zone. He wants to work with her, respect her position, but he also wants to incrementally help expose her to the unknown. And so I think that's really important too. Respect for where people do fall on that spectrum as a leader or manager is important. Not everyone can be what he calls an adventurer. Yeah. At the same time, it is really healthy for everybody's mental well-being to move toward openness to uncertainty. Because as one scientist told me, if you have difficulty with uncertainty, then you're having difficulty with life.
Yes, you can't separate it.
No, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And with, you know, the anxious generation, as we're naming a lot of the Gen Z participants entering the workplace, I know Mel Robbins' book lately on Let Them Theory has been sort of landing with a lot of popularity as well, that we maybe have become a little too controlling over the last a couple of decades, and now it's an opportunity to embrace this uncertainty and say, hey, let them go and try this, or let's go and do a little bit more of this exposure therapy with delegating that task and seeing what comes back in a short window of time.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are studies that show that intolerance of uncertainty is rising. And many experts that I've talked to think that's the case in the United States. And also in terms of complex political topics and discussions, epistemic hubris, which is basically unwarranted certainty about what you know about topics like gun control, is rising. And so it's, but when we think about turning this all on its head, our assumptions that unpredictability is wrong or bad, or that, we have to control the rising sense of precarity that we have, if we flip that on its head, then we become, I see the surfboard in your background there, we become surfers of life. We face the unknown with curiosity and wonder. Again, it's not comfy. It's not, cozy. It's not a picnic. But the other thing is, all of these strategies and, new techniques can be done in a few minutes.
Yes.
This is not something where you don't have to stay outside of your comfort zone all the time, because life can be sometimes very predictable, even within the changes that we're having right now. This is kind of your special, I hate to use the word superpower, but anyhow, I will. Nope. The superpower of uncertainty for those special times when, you face something new, unexpected, or ambiguous, and that unease is your signal that you can be and are unsure, and then that's the time to lean into it and wield the tools, the strategies you have to inhabit the question, or focus less on outcome, or even just do the self-talk of cue words. Athletes, tell themselves to be in the game rather than focus on the score or how they're doing.
Yes.
I think cue words are very helpful. There are two takeaways or strategies I can offer for teams, particularly in and around positive disagreement. One is, don't be afraid of the word maybe. I call it maybe power. Now, a maybe is a kind of word called a hedge word. You might have heard of them. Hedge words are words like sometimes or possibly or could or things like that. I was quoting hedge words when I was talking about the Mars exploration rover kind of conversations. And we often assume that those are weak, and many people assume that they're feminine or female. That's not true. Studies out of Harvard show that when leaders in particular use hedge words, two things occur. One, linguistically, they're signaling their receptiveness to other people's point of view, going back to that inclusiveness. And two, they're signaling that there's something more to know. Wonderful. I mean, amazing. Maybe is powerful. The second takeaway I'd say from all this work on disagreement and uncertainty is, from the Mars mission, they had a ritual. They called it the listening ritual. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every meeting, small, two-person or huge, hundreds of people, they had a ritual where the person in charge at the time ended the call or the meeting by asking, what don't we know? Or is there anyone who disagrees? And at that time, people who did raise their hand, whether or not they were the intern or the senior scientist, people who raised their hand weren't seen as jerks. They weren't seen as slowing down progress. They were seen as assets to the team. And that couldn't be more powerful. Very simple little thing to do. But again, you might have a silence at the end of the first meeting or the second meeting or even the third meeting. But keep it up, because practice is what people need with these kind of slightly uncomfortable things. And the payback is tremendous.
I really like that one. What don't we know, or what do we disagree with? We've run a few interesting internal workshops unintentionally that have leveraged that, where we'll say, okay, Jenna, it's your job in the next hour to keep highlighting what we might not know, what assumptions there may be here that we haven't actually gone back and tested. And it kind of gives someone a job on the team and you've invited them to do it. So they're expected to come up with stuff. So you've kind of normalized, you've lowered that sort of threat around speaking up against other people's work.
I think that's beautiful. And also, from all of the research I've seen, the naming of a devil's advocate actually doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's very artificial. It tends to cause ruffled feathers. People don't like having that job. So
no.
I think the goal should be organic. And also, one thing about uncertainty and disagreement is that when you change the mindset to become questioning and skeptical, it occurs for the whole group. Again, the onus isn't on the one dissenter. The onus isn't on the one leader to hammer out dissenting opinions or the devil's advocate. The onus, and I mean actually the exciting opportunity, becomes mm-hmm. for the entire group. And there's one wonderful little story, very brief, from the Mars rover annals of history. Somebody actually at one point uploaded faulty software commands to one of the rovers. I mean, these are robots worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Oof. And so this team, you know, the leaders called an all-hands meeting for the first time. And instead of saying, you know, get back on the same page, the leaders actually said, quote, we need to get back to that place of questioning. That's how we got to where we are. You know, we need to be saying, I don't know, I don't disagree. So they just called everybody and asked for, you know, disagreement and uncertainty.
Yeah.
And it was a really amazing moment. They also sent, after it happened, rather than call an immediate meeting, they sent everyone home. They put the rovers to sleep. And then they sent everyone home for a long weekend of reflection, which is really, wow. I know. Yeah. Isn't that unusual?
That's so against the grain. Like normally, hey, guys, we missed the sales target last month, so we're all going to get in and have a big Monday. But actually saying, hey, we missed the sales target last month, take Monday off, and let's come in Tuesday and see what's bubbling up.
Yeah. Give people a moment to think.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's very much part of the process. And isn't that, that's a beautiful, yet another iteration of uncertainty, because what is uncertainty? It is many scientists across different disciplines separately told me it was a space of possibilities. It's also moments of suspense, because if you're expanding the space between question and answer, then you have suspense, you know. So uncertainty is allowing a kind of activity that wouldn't happen otherwise, and then you can make use of it. But it's suspense, you know.
Yeah.
And we're built as humans. I mean, I love a good mystery. And if I knew what was going to happen on page 3, it would not be a good mystery.
No, absolutely not. Actually, that ties into a final question I wanted to put to you, Maggie, around uncertainty, which is uncertainty and feedback. So there's been a huge focus on feedback the last 5 or 10 years in the workplace. Hey, don't surprise your team members with news about their performance, you know, a year later, or give people the opportunity for growth. However, that same podcast I referenced earlier with Marcus Buckingham talked about the fact that our feedback is heavily biased by our own, you know, perspective on how things should be done. And he explained that it's better that we remove that judgment of feedback and go more curiously forward and say, hey, Maggie, let's talk about, you know, something that's going well for you and why, and something that's not going well for you or for me. Like, hey, when we have meetings to talk about sales prospects, I always find like we're misaligned. Why might that be? So he creates more of a conversation than going in and saying, you need to follow this process in your sales call. Did you see any of that in your research, or do you have a viewpoint on, you know, how we may be doing feedback wrong and maybe embracing uncertainty and possibility is actually a better way to have performance-related conversations one-to-one?
Yes, I think that some of the research does shed light, or could shed light on that aspect. I mean, first of all, the maybe word is part of a lot of research on conversational receptiveness. So that's being open to, you know, others and to what might happen rather than coming in, you know. Feedback, it seems, often is about not measuring up to a preordained outcome or standard, instead of exploring what could be in all sides and possibilities, and what better place than conversation, which is a, you know, an enterprise of exploring the unknown, or at least it can be, in order to, you know, find what else you don't know, or what the person who's the recipient and the giver of feedback might be able to learn. And uncertainty, because it sets us up to learn, it sets us up to be, you know, acutely observant and discerning, then it also equips us to be in the unknown together. The last point is that circling back to that personality trait, people who are more intolerant of uncertainty have a particular type of, well, this is more related to arguments, but I think it could also be about feedback. People who are more intolerant of uncertainty argue to win. They argue to score points. They don't like spaces or pauses or emptiness. And people who are tolerant of uncertainty are no less assertive. They're no less assertive. They're better negotiators, and they argue to learn, and they're willing to admit that they don't know, which opens up space. That's again, the maybe or the I don't know is allowing something else to happen. So instead of having a talking at somebody, you're talking with, and then you're launching into, again, it's not a rudderless, it's not being adrift, it's not being without a goal. I love to think of, you know, certain types of thought as controlled drift. You're within the rubric of still having a performance review or giving feedback, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you are loosening the fetters, allowing more to happen. We can't mistake or conflate this with passivity, which it's not. This is not let it be. This is not, you know, whatever, I don't really care. No, it's really active and far more creative, because just as good decision-making is in new situations, in complex, new, ambiguous situations, good decision-making is moving from what you already know or not getting stuck. So too is creativity. That's the root of creativity.
Yeah.
Moving away from what's already known, what everybody already has done before, that's the place you want to be. And so you can really trace some of the greatest human or facets of human capability to that capacity to operate well in the unknown.
Yeah.
And I think it's really very, I almost say it means a lot to me to think about this possibility within uncertainty in terms of relationships.
Yeah.
Because again, along with outcome orientation, I think there's such an onus, no matter where we are, as a mom, as a parent, as a friend, as a book club member, as a manager, there's such an onus on fixing. And one of the wonderful takeaways from this book research was that, in particular, just as an example, but also it's true with friends, I became a lot less focused on giving people a solution when they came to me with a problem.
Yeah.
And that sounds like I'm not being a good friend or a mother, but actually I've become much more open to not having a specific instant suggestion.
Yeah.
Which kind of erases this space, the liminal space that they're in. When you can be in the space of uncertainty, then you can let them take the lead, but you can also understand the roots of their problem more. And somehow it's just a much, much more humane way to be.
Oh, it really is. And actually, a couple of those key points you touched on there, Maggie, like having creativity as a goal for a performance appraisal is a great goal for any leader or team member to take in. Like, hey, what are we going to create from this conversation, rather than the defensiveness or the attack, depending on who's on which side of the conversation. And so that leads into better relationships. But your point there as well on not fixing and being more about the process, like that's a lot of the work that I've been doing with a couple of podcast guests, certainly my therapist, on like when someone brings a problem to you and they feel badly about it and you rationalize and say, here's the solution. You haven't actually seen them as a human for what they're feeling and what they're going through and how vulnerable they've been in sharing something with you. So actually, it actually damages relationships by going into that fixed mindset, which is so counterintuitive.
Right. But we have to be forgiving, and I know you are, of all the messages we get of the contemporary life we live. You know, we live on these sort of neat templates online, and we live in boxed moments, and we get messaging of, for hundreds of years, the message has been efficiency at all cost and therefore speed. You know, what is rational intelligence is, you know, really just getting a goal and barreling toward it, you know, however you can in the most linear fashion. So I see this as a really big crossroads moment, as a sort of a seismic opportunity for us to change what it means to be successful, to be in relation to one another, to listen to voices that haven't been heard, including voice greatness in uncertainty in history. I think there's a book that needs to be written, like Martin Luther King, or, you know, so many people who are unsung had greatness through uncertainty, not despite their uncertainty. Even George Washington was criticized for reflecting. I think that it's a really great opportunity. Even though it seems a time of such great challenge as well.
Yeah, I think that's hugely uplifting. I certainly feel the energy from our conversations. And I think that you've shared here today some really cool practical sound bites and tips for any, you know, teams that are trying to lift their relationships and their possibility together.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's great. Wonderful, inspiring questions. And I love the conversation too.
Thanks, Maggie. One of the big takeaways that I had there was that become great thinkers together. Like that should be the tagline for why people actually do teamwork.
Exactly. Because I write, why come together to be less than the sum of our remarkable parts?
Yeah.
And I also would love to read I'm sure we're running out of time, but I love this quote by Aristotle, who wrote, "No one individual knows the whole of the truth, and no one individual fails entirely. Yeah. Everyone says something true about the nature of things." I love that quote.
It is. It's wonderful. It's so positively framed in like being curious and inviting everyone to participate and not pointing fingers, which is, you know, the corporate coat of arms. I think as organizations that are focused on efficiency, we love a scapegoat, and that quote really encourages us all to take accountability and ownership for what we're all capable of doing together.
Right. Things change, as we were talking about. Things change. Another minute, and the person you're ignoring might be the hero.
Yeah. And I've seen that multiple times on the sports field and in the corporate environment too. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, for any of our guests that haven't yet come across your book or your work, where do they best find you and your material, Maggie?
I think a good starting point is my website. So you can Google Maggie Jackson Uncertain or go to maggie-jackson.com.
Awesome. Well, I highly recommend it. And I continue to enjoy the friendship and the learning opportunities, Maggie. So thanks for the time today.
Thank you. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,